Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times, and Anne-Marie Batson, the journalist and broadcaster. Ambition comes at a price, financially and professionally. Chelsea have already spent £200 million in the transfer market this summer. It would surprise no one if another £80 million or so is added to the bill before the window closes. With such investment comes expectation. Frank Lampard might be a club legend, but the need for success overwhelms sentiment. He has to produce this season, maybe even win the Premier League title. Liverpool, the champions, are at the bridge on Sunday. People are going to leap to conclusions, aren't they, Johnny?
I mean, it's a test that Frank Lampard could probably have done without at this stage of the season, because as you say, Mike, that level of spending does raise expectation, and history tells us at Chelsea that when the owner invests in players and when his expectations are high, then the manager is under a lot of pressure to deliver. And it's Frank Lampard's got a lot of new players to assimilate into his team. He's probably working on structure and combinations. And in that scenario, what you don't want is to be playing a team like Liverpool, who are the benchmark at the moment. They are the measure for everybody else, not just in terms of, you know, the output in terms of points, obviously, but just their standards, their kind of intensity, their teamwork and so on. And I think Liverpool on their day could really show Chelsea up if they're not careful. They'll certainly have to play better than they played against Brighton. And I think we'll come away from that game with a much clearer picture of what has actually changed, if anything, at Chelsea. You know, are they going to take the next step? Has that £200 million made a difference? Or are they going to be a sort of pretty team that's going to give us great moments in the season but not sustain it? And we'll have a much better idea after that game.
Inevitably, because so much of football is sort of melted down into managerial mano-a-mano stuff, Anne-Marie, there'll be a lot of attention focused on Jurgen Klopp's comments about Chelsea's spending. But isn't the reality that the biggest clubs all do so, albeit at different stages of their development?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Mike. And also, we have to bear in mind that Chelsea have come out of a ban. They were reliant on the youth team, the academy players, to get them through key parts of the season last season. So it's no surprise now that Frank has been given the funds to develop the squad as he sees fit. It's probably the first time actually he can build the squad as to what he wants. So I'm not surprised that Chelsea have gone out and done the spending. I'm a little bit surprised though with Klopp though. I didn't expect him to go so early about the spending. Maybe he's genuinely concerned about it, but then he forgets, I guess, that in terms of the squad, you know, Chelsea, they had £307 million squad play that game against Brighton, whereas against the win against Leeds for Liverpool, it was £350 million I saw in the newspaper. So I do find it a little bit amusing, very much so. And Jonathan mentioned about Chelsea having to play better than what they did against Brighton. I think Liverpool got a real shock, even though they got that win against Leeds. I think that was a real eye-opener about where the vulnerability is, and it's definitely at the back. And now that Chelsea have spent a lot of money on improving their attacking force, I think Liverpool need to be a little bit worried about potentially Chelsea being able to fire the ball behind the defensive line, I think. And, you know, so I'm excited for this. I'm really looking forward to this. I feel like this is a potential beef that's going to run for the next few months.
I suppose, you know, you talked there, Anne-Marie, about Liverpool's defensive issues. What about Chelsea's, Johnny? Do they all stem from Kepa? And are you convinced by Lampard's public profession of faith? You know, teams are definitely targeting that goalkeeper, aren't they? And is he just basically trying to maintain a semblance of transfer value?
Well, I mean, Kepa's a kind of fascinating case in point in how Chelsea are run, because it looks to me like there's club politics there. You know, this is a kid that's been recruited for an extraordinary fee on the sort of say, and they, look, first thing to say is Chelsea have got a brilliant record of picking up talent, but they've recruited him for a huge fee, taking a big risk on a player that hadn't really got established in Spain. And successive managers have been asked to play him despite his different problems. That's not just in terms of his performances, but we remember his behaviour during the Carabao Cup final. But he's had to play, and that tells me that there's pressure from above. And Lampard was playing Willy Caballero last season, which, you know, it isn't like playing a kind of, you know, young thrusting number two. That's playing your kind of guy that really is just there as a backup. But playing him instead in really big games last season. So I know, I don't think he does have tremendous faith in Kepa. Why would you have faith in Kepa? He hasn't done it. He looks vulnerable in all sorts of ways. He's got David De Gea's vulnerabilities without David De Gea's sort of plus points to me. But I don't think it's fair to blame him for all of the defensive problems. They look very structural to me. Chelsea have had a problem since Frank arrived against counterattacks. They seem to commit a lot of players forward. They have a lot of attacking players on the pitch. So when, you know, even the defenders, it's as if he chooses them with their attacking capabilities in mind. You could say, you know, Reece James or Alonso were playing against Brighton, who are both there for what they do, sort of surging forward. Now, that's great, brilliant, you know, nice to see. But who's guarding the shop at the back? You know, who's protecting Kepa? You add in the fact that perhaps Kante physically has had a couple of years where he's had little injuries and hasn't been at that incredible peak that he was when he won Footballer of the Year. And Jorginho's never been very mobile, so isn't very good at getting around to sort of block off counterattacks. And that team that were blitzed by Arsenal in the cup final, it looked like they had the same structure against Brighton, who really could have scored three or four, and they had better strikers on the pitch. So it's not all Kepa. Kepa's a problem, and there's politics there, but there's far more work to be done, and I think Frank's got to think seriously about the structure of that team.
Yeah, you know, I concur with that. You know, okay, it's all very well saying, well, Chilwell's going to come in, Thiago Silva's got fantastic experience. But actually, when you look at that logically, are they going to improve that defence? It's a 50-50 call at the moment. Amory, you know, we spoke about the pressure that Frank Lampard's under, and I suppose it's understandable that given the spending that he's pivoting away from that initial faith in youth. Is that understandable? And let's look at a case in point, if we could, please. Ruben Loftus-Cheek, by all common consent, he was really poor at Brighton. Is he one of those young players who's probably had enough chances and we'll be seeing him going out the door in one of those sort of 25 million transfers?
I think it is a little bit understandable that Frank Lampard needs to pivot away from youth, because the one glaring thing that he needs to sort out is the massive gap between himself and the other teams. You know, finishing, you know, 33-point gap, that is a big gap to close down. And I think senior players need to be a part of that to help sort that out for Frank. And I think that's going to be a massive priority for him. And even though he has got these new signings with Timo Werner, Havertz and Thiago Silva, other players have struggled. And unfortunately, Ruben Loftus-Cheek falls into that group. And perhaps it's time now that Chelsea do cash in. And I appreciate that Loftus-Cheek needs time to regain his form and full fitness. But there's also, I think, my personal belief is, I think there's a lack of confidence as well, because he has been out for so much time. So perhaps maybe a loan move instead will help just build his confidence back up. And also, you've seen in terms of the youth, we see Tarek Lamptey, of course, he made that decision to go to Brighton, and I give him full props for that, because he could have taken the easy option to stay and try and win his place. But I think the writing was on the wall when you've got Azzi Piliquetta and Reece James in front of you, and you want to be playing week in, week out. He's taken a bit of a risk and a gamble and has decided to go to Brighton, and well done for him for making that decision. And maybe Ruben Loftus-Cheek needs to look at the bigger picture, the long game. Where is the best place for me to build up my confidence where I can get regular first team football? And I don't think at this time, with that 33-point gap Frank needs people that's going to be on point, and I'm not sure Ruben Loftus-Cheek is able to do that.
Yeah. What about, you know, we mentioned earlier on, Johnny, about people, you know, can't wait to leap to conclusions about this Chelsea team. What are your first impressions of Werner, who looked pretty sharp and very quick, and Havertz? What were your first impressions of them?
I mean, Havertz is someone I've got huge time for, just sort of a little personal thing. I saw him when he was 17 in a game playing for Leverkusen. We were invited across, a couple of journalists, to watch Bayern Munich, and he was just a kid that had that understanding of the game at a really precocious age. And I think he will be a superb player, but I have to say his debut didn't suggest that. If you hadn't seen him in Germany, you might have been wondering what the fuss was about. But, you know, first game, probably playing out of position a little bit. I mean, there's a problem that they've got. They've got that Everton, that problem Everton had about 4 years ago. They've got about 10 number 10s at the club. So I think Havertz is probably the one that emerges as the number 10 because he cost 90 million. But Werner's an interesting point because he has got, you know, pace to burn so fast. He was clocked at Leipzig at a 30 meter time that was quicker than Usain Bolt's when he was running the 100 meters record. I mean,
seriously.
I mean, bearing in mind, wow, Usain's not sprinting over 30 meters; he's sprinting over 100. So I guess he could have done it quicker if he needed to. But nevertheless, in their sprint testing, Werner was quicker over 30 meters than when Bolt broke the world record in his first 30 meters. Superb pace and, you know, you could see when he got in the box, he wanted to shoot all the time, which is what you want from a striker. Again, so I've got no doubts about him whatsoever. Again, it's a question of structure. He's a player that you need to be feeding balls through to give him space to run onto. And Leipzig used him wide. They used him like Liverpool used Salah. And it looks like Chelsea are using him through the middle, which again means a kind of reorganization of his game. So He and Havertz were both, I felt, playing a little bit out of the positions that they're most comfortable in, and it just added to the question marks I've got about how's this Chelsea team going to fit together? Because on first impressions, it looks like a long way from being a kind of settled structure that's going to give them security at the back, but also going to get the best out of those players. And he's going to need to get the best out of Havertz and Werner because they're pinning their hopes on them this season.
Absolutely. Yeah, talking of settled structures, Amory, what about Liverpool? How do you see that team evolving? You know, if we look at the front three, the fab three, is that unit potentially in its last season?
Oh, that's such a tough question to answer. Yeah, potentially they lost. No, I think we've still got some time to go with those top three, I think, because I think they've demonstrated if one person is not firing, you've still got another two that you can rely on. And I think Salah looked hungry at the weekend. He really did look up for it. And we didn't really see that towards the end of the season. And I know there was a lot of focus on Mane and Firmino, and Salah did play his part, to be fair, but he wasn't firing on all cylinders, I would say, towards the latter part of last season. So this season, he looks really, really up for it. And I think he really wants to go for that golden boot as well. So I think we've got at least another season or two enjoying that front three. When they're all together, they're just an amazing, amazing strike force. So yeah, I think we've got a little bit of time with them yet.
Okay. I'll throw another hand grenade then, Johnny. If you were Declan Rice,
oh wow,
would you agitate to leave West Ham and join Chelsea?
Gosh, I'm sort of running away from that one, Mike.
I told you he was angry.
Yeah. For him personally, first of all, you've got to think he's got the history with Chelsea and he's extremely close in terms of friendship with Mason Mount and some of the lads that he came through with. So there'll be an obvious lure there. And I guess it's kind of when an ex makes a big play for you to get you back. It must be personally quite flattering that, you know, having dumped.
That's never happened to me, mate.
No, I was trying to think if it's ever happened to me. But yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that now, you know, they've kind of almost admitted they were wrong and they want him back and all that kind of stuff. And then on the other hand, there's a kind of tug on the heartstrings at West Ham because, you know, I spent some time with David Moyes recently and he was telling me that, you know, he sees Declan Rice as being the guy that's going to sort of accept the torch from Mark Noble and become the heart and soul of West Ham. And it's there for him to be sort of his club and all that kind of stuff. And you know, obviously he'll get to play wherever he wants and be the first name on the team sheet there. So on a sort of personal level, I guess he will be torn. And, you know, he's already faced that kind of thing with Ireland and England in his career. So a lot of decisions at an early age. But I guess you've got to be very hard-headed about it and say that he will not be challenging for trophies at West Ham. It's an enormous opportunity for him to become a legend. It's a great club for that. But to win things, I guess he's got a better chance at Chelsea. And my hunch is that he will end up at Chelsea eventually, but just not this season. I cannot see West Ham countenancing losing him at the moment, especially not after Diangana's gone, you know, which left Moyes furious and a lot of the players furious in terms of, you know, wanting to keep young talents. I think politically he can't move this year. But I think long term I could see him back at Chelsea to fulfil the sort of greater ambitions.
You know David very well,
yeah.
Down the years. How did you find him? And you know, I look at it as a as an outsider that there's someone, you know, who's got great managerial expertise and experience and acumen, probably let down by those higher up the food chain than him. How does a manager of his experience deal with that problem? Or how is he dealing with it?
I mean, he's experienced now, I suppose. So he's fought those battles before at different places. So I'd say that he can kind of, he's got perspective. He can kind of see where they're coming from, the owners, in the sense that, you know, there's a need this summer to try and sell players in order to give him some money to spend. And, you know, I think he would probably be happy to offload one or two of those sort of senior fancy players who maybe haven't quite produced, your Yarmolenkos or Lanzinis or Andersons, you know, whatever. But there's no interest in them. So the interest has actually been in the younger talent, unfortunately. So, you know, he's got some understanding of that. But, I mean, he's impatient, Mike. He's David can see the potential of West Ham. He was saying to me it's got the most potential of any club, you know, in the Premier League that's unfulfilled. And he knows what he wants to do with it. He wants to build something there along the lines of Everton. He thinks they can be the club that hits that gap that in the market that Everton did. And he's got all these ideas for restructuring and doing recruitment in a different way and you know, building step by step, which is perhaps at odds with what's above him. So I guess I'm probably talking around it a little bit, maybe so as just to be sensitive. But I think he's, I mean, the other thing I'd have to say is his relationship with David Sullivan's pretty decent, actually, despite maybe what some of the portrayals have been. They've both been around the block quite a lot. But what I am pretty sure of is that he will, having lost Diangana, which he didn't want to do, he will be pushing really hard now to get his way on a lot of other things. And that would be James Tarkowski, perhaps, or an experienced defender. And that would certainly be keeping Declan Rice and pushing maybe for some of those things in the background to maybe get West Ham back up to speed, you know, recruitment-wise and in other departments.
Can I add to that? I mean, he's facing a horrible run. I think this is probably one of the worst runs, haven't he, Jonathan, for the next... Well, I think I was looking at it last night. It was like facing six of the last season's top eight in the next six games, including Arsenal and Leicester. That is a nightmare scenario for West Ham.
And that Newcastle result was a nightmare because, you know, David is very... We talked about that. He's very aware of that horrendous run and just, you know, he's saying, God, if we just get through that, then the season starts to open up. But probably needed something out of that game against Newcastle. So that was horrific, really, that result.
Because, you know, if you look at it in the short term, Anne-Marie, Arsenal on Sunday probably is the promise of more pain, isn't it? And it will inevitably, I suppose, summon some memories of Jack Wilshere, who... You know, do you agree with me that he's probably going to end up being regarded as one of the great lost talents?
No, I don't think so, because at the moment he's injury free. And I think that is what has pretty much curtailed Jack Wilshere's career. And I sigh at Jack Wilshere because the potential that he had, it just, I'm sad for him. And I don't want to pity him because that would be completely wrong. But I'm sensitive to the fact that his body has not allowed him to develop into the player that he wants to be. And I think the contribution that he made to Arsenal was immense, and he'll forever be loved by us Gooners. But he's not been able to deliver on that promise at Bournemouth, and it's the same at West Ham as well. So I'm for Declan Rice, I keep him separate because he's pretty much been injury-free and he's featured frequently in the England squad. Obviously, Southgate has got a lot of faith in him as a player as well. So I think I agree with Jonathan. I think Declan Rice needs to stay at West Ham for another season. I do wonder if Chelsea think if he's ready from a technical point of view, and if he stays for another year at West Ham, he'll be able to develop on that. And if they are able to bring James Tarkowski in from Burnley, that can only help develop Declan Rice as a defensive midfielder. So I'm not going to say that he's along the same lines as Jack Wilshere. I think we're well away from that at the moment. It's just a case of him staying injury free and continue being the player that West Ham need over the next six games, at least, to get them through this rough period.
Yeah, as you say, you are a gooner. You must be quite happy with life at the moment. Aubameyang's signed his contract. Arteta, you know, is beginning to evolve as at least a Wenger light. You know, what's your overall impression, Amory, of the way that that team, that squad, maybe the ethos of the club is beginning to develop?
Okay, if I'm allowed to put my gooner hat on for a second, I'm delighted that the way that the squad is going, and I'm delighted that Arteta is now starting to see the fruits of his labour. They've obviously worked really, really hard on the training pitch, particularly with their pressing, making sure that they're tracking back. You know, you wouldn't have seen a year ago, you wouldn't see Aubameyang tracking back, and now he is, which is an absolute revelation. My slight reservation is about Emi Martinez going to Aston Villa. I kind of hoped that would fall by the wayside. Not because I don't think Aston Villa deserve a good keeper, because they do. And I'm sure Tom Heaton is slightly concerned that Emi Martinez is now going to be potentially the number one there. But I think for us, I think he was immense in those last 12 games and he offered us an alternative. I felt more confident with Martinez being in goal when we needed to play out from the back than I do with Bernd Leno. There were times where Bernd Leno took some unnecessary risks, and that, you know, at the time our defence wasn't that brilliant. It's going to be vastly improved now with the signings that we've brought in. But at the time, I did worry about that. And I thought Martinez, he just offered something extra to that backline defence, commanding the setup pieces and so on and so forth. And I did hope that Arsenal could maybe find a way of keeping him in some shape or form. But I accept the fact that they've reluctantly let him go, and it has been a reluctant sell because he wants to be number one, and who are we as Arsenal to stop him from doing that? But at the same time, can Bernd Leno play goalkeeper for every single game? And if he suffers, touch wood, I hope this doesn't happen, touch wood, but if he was to suffer another injury, where does that leave Arsenal again? So I wish Emi Martinez all the best, and I'm sure he'll be brilliant at Aston Villa, but I do say that with a bit of a heavy heart. I'm delighted that Aubameyang has signed the contract. It's been a long time coming, for sure. I'm sure that's offered a lot of reinsurance. It's now a question if they can get one more signing in and maybe Torreira going on loan or being sold abroad. I think Arsenal will be pretty much there.
Good. Can I steer you across North London, Johnny? Spurs. Gareth Bale, it looks pretty likely now that he'll be on his way from Madrid, you know, possibly as early as later today. Let's assess the logic of the deal. Looks like, you know, it will be a loan deal, Spurs playing about half his wages, so around about £15 million. Now, he's only 31 and he hasn't got as many miles on the clock as others. You know, he only played 1,200 minutes last season, for instance. Why shouldn't Spurs do a deal like this, provided his attitude is right?
Yeah, I mean, look, at my old age, there's a few signings that get you excited, but this is actually one, just from a neutral's point of view, I'm quite thrilled about, really, to see Bale back in the Premier League, but also somewhere that is kind of spiritually important to him, that's going to inspire him, because, you know, we're talking about one of the best British players in history when he's at his best. And I think the question marks about his motivation and character are, I think that's propaganda, actually, that the Real Madrid machine has put out over the years to justify his exclusion by Zidane. I think you only have to look at Gareth Bale for Wales to see the character that he's got, the leadership he takes on. But also think about him throughout his career. This is a kid that was absolutely written off at one point, who Harry Redknapp thought was jinxed because he couldn't win a game with Gareth Bale in the 11. You know, he was in such a difficult position early in his Spurs career, and to build up to become the player he has done. You know, he's got huge reserves of character, and will I'm sure be the right fit that way for Spurs. The logic from their point of view, it's clear that they're thinking short term now. It's clear, you know, which is what you get with Mourinho. Appointing Mourinho was an opportunity, an attempt to accelerate Spurs towards becoming something that would win. And the whole, you know, the whole documentary is about here comes the troubleshooter to turn this bunch of, you know, blah blah blah. Josie's gonna whip them into shape.
All it needed was spaghetti western music. That one, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, exactly. And Jose, you know, is playing exactly that part. He's trying to harden them up. He's trying to make them winners. Signing Gareth Bale and perhaps, you know, being willing to let someone like Dele Alli go, it just shows that, you know, they let Kyle Walker-Peters go, maybe Eric Lamella will go. These are the players they were trying to develop, and they're in a different phase now. Mourinho does tend to deliver at some point and then just leave wreckage behind him, and I wonder if that's where we are with Spurs. But for this season, this might be the delivering season, and Gareth Bale gives him a much better chance of delivering, of course.
Yeah, like you, I think he's been grossly underestimated, and you're right that he has been a victim of the propaganda system in Madrid. You know, having spoken to him there, I've always been impressed by how grounded he is, and you know the work ethic that he does have. You know, all this stuff about him, you know, basically being only comfortable when he's over a wedge shot into the 15th green is just nonsense. Dele Amery, again, I suppose he can learn from Bale in the way that he's sustained a career right at the top. We've lost the Dele of two seasons ago. Do you think his career does need a jump start? And if so, where? There's talk that he would go the other way to Madrid, which, you know, might be frying pan and fire. I don't know.
Do you know what? When I was watching the documentary, I was amazed how softly spoken Dele Alli is. I expected him to be this kind of loud, in your face kind of character, and he wasn't at all. He was very quiet. So I mean, he learned how to cook beans finally in a microwave, but apart from that, his character, he wasn't what I expected at all. And I remember, Mike, that talk when he was around about 19-20 years old about him going to PSG. I remember that, and all the expectation and the hype that came with that, and then it's died away now, potentially. I think, yes, it's I think a move away from Spurs would be a benefit for him, for sure. I think he could, the potential of Bale now coming to Spurs means there's going to be even more attacking midfielder options available for Mourinho. So I think Dele needs to really think about how he can move his career forward. I don't want to say that he hasn't lived up to expectation yet, because he's only 24 years old. And I think we tend to forget that sometimes. He's still a young person in terms of his career. He's still got time on his side. But the one thing that is on his CV is he wants to be back into the England team. And with the Euros coming up next year, he will need regular football to break back in. And if that means moving away to Real Madrid or to another team that can guarantee him that, then it's a smart move. For sure. And it's a chance to revive his talent as well. I think it's a bit of a shame that, you know, from the talk within the documentary, I did get the sense that Mourinho wanted to try and work with him and tease that special skill that he brings back to the pitch, and it hasn't delivered on that front. So I think, yeah, Alli, take a move, 100% take a move. If somebody comes on and gives you a good offer on the table, take it. Because I think for you, your priority is to get back into the England squad and play for the Euros for next year.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because if you look at their schedule, Johnny, John Cross, friend of this programme, put out a tweet today, which, to be honest, took me by surprise, where he actually articulated the fixture schedule that Spurs have got. Forgive me, I'll run through it really quickly. They're playing Lokomotiv Plovdiv tonight in the Europa League. Sunday they've got Southampton in the Prem. Leighton Orient in the League Cup on Tuesday. On Thursday, they've got a Europa League qualifier. Saturday, they've got Newcastle at home. The following Thursday, potentially a Europa League playoff. And then, by the way, on October the 3rd, they've got Manchester United, subject to changing for TV. That's one heck of a schedule. And there's no surprise that an articulate, intelligent footballer like Eric Dyer is basically saying, hang on a second, you're killing us.
Yeah, it's horrific. And that illustrates where clubs are, where, you know, we've got this truncated season and none of the money-making agencies, i.e. the leagues, the FAs, the international federations, are willing to give ground on fixtures. So what happens? I get shunted down the line to the players. You can just play more and you just play all the time. And Spurs are at the very sharp end of that. And I think they face the added complication of, first of all, Mourinho isn't a manager who likes to have a sort of big squad and rotate a lot. His style's always been to keep it tight, to keep his kind of small band and to play them quite a lot. I think Spurs, I spoke to one of the Spurs players recently and they were saying how, we were asking about lockdown and he was saying how hard they'd worked. They were on Zoom every day and they were doing, you know, kind of squad stuff, exercises. So I think mentally they probably didn't get the kind of break in lockdown that people might think. So they've played the season, had that short break, and Mourinho's worked them quite hard ever since they got back. So I think they'll be mentally quite frazzled. Plus they've had that documentary and all the tension around it, the upheaval at the club. And, you know, this is off the back of Pochettino and all that happened last year. So I think they must be quite tired already. And that's worrying going into something like this. And those Plovdiv games aren't games that they can give away lightly. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, when I talk about Mourinho delivering, it's more likely to be a Europa League or a cup. So he'll take those cups seriously. These guys will not get a rest. And they're all international players as well. It's kind of cruel on them, I think. Not that some listeners might just think, oh, well, they earn a lot of money, blah, blah, blah. They're still human beings, and I think they're going to be mentally and physically tired.
Yeah, I think they do deserve more support, definitely. Yeah, I mentioned Manchester United at the end of that, Anne-Marie. They start against Palace on Saturday. What expectations do you have for them this season?
Do you know what? They surprised me finishing third in the Premier League last season. I wouldn't have, if you'd asked me last year, where do you think Manchester United would have finished? I would have said either sixth or fifth. I didn't expect them to finish third at all. So my expectation is that they will want to improve on that and finish second or first. But of course, Liverpool and Manchester City will have something to say about that. I think there's been, I hope the talk about Jadon Sancho has not been a distraction for Manchester United too much. I think they'll still do what they need to do. They're going to be meeting a team that they've had an interesting play against. They'll come into that game against Crystal Palace with some momentum, of course. But also Crystal Palace will come into that game with a little bit of momentum as well. So my expectation is I think they're going to go for all cups possible. They're back in the Champions League. They'll want to try and win the Premier League. They'll want to win the League Cup and the FA Cup as well. I think Bruno Fernandes is going to play a massive part this season for them as well. I'm slightly concerned about Marcus Rashford because he's a little bit injury prone at the moment. I'm hoping that they can come up with a plan B when he's not available for them. But also the goalkeeping situation as well. I'm interested to see how that's going to play out because we now know that Dean Henderson has signed a contract back with United, but David De Gea is still there. As far as I'm aware, he's still the number one goalkeeper. So how is that going to work forward? Will Henderson push De Gea to become a better goalkeeper, or are they going to split their duties, or will potentially Henderson become the number one? I think that's something that I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to have to clarify fairly quickly, because if he wants to improve that position, particularly in the Premier League, he's going to have to choose which goalkeeper is going to be help them to achieve that.
Yeah, let's broaden the conversation if we could, please, Johnny. Still with a United theme, Mason Greenwood. It does appear that it's open season on him in certain sections of the media. I find that depressingly predictable. You know, when we're talking about the instances of, you know, Raheem Sterling, are we in our trade? Do we have to look hard at our trade and think, what are we trying to do here? What are certain individuals or certain institutions trying to do to young players? Because, you know, frankly, that was so derivative, what has happened over the last couple of weeks. It just depresses the life out of me as someone who, you know, as you know, without being over the top, you know, given it's been part of my life, you know, the journalism has been my life, you know?
I know, Mike. I mean, you know, you use the word derivative there, and I share your feelings. I feel there's an old-fashioned type of journalism that should have died out years ago. And I'm not even sure the public want it anymore. And targeting someone like Mason Greenwood, look, he made a mistake in Iceland. And of course, that's a story. I'm not going to pretend that's not a great story in kind of, you know, tabloid terms. Of course, that's a story. But there needs to be perspective. He's an 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid. The naivety was startling. But would I maybe have done the same in the same position, same opportunity? I'd possibly. I mean, we've all been 19. There needs to be some human kind of understanding, really, of that. So that's not the complaint, but to follow that up, you know, with let's now it's open season on Mason Greenwood is at that age just, yeah, it's that old-fashioned journalism, and I don't think the public like it. I really don't. It struck me that if Fergie was still Manchester United manager, he would have his arm around Mason Greenwood and he'd be saying, this is what happens when you go away with England. You can't trust the FA. You don't need that in your life, son. You know, and he'd use this as to Man United's advantage. But
spoken like a true Scot, if I may say so.
Oh, I know. I used to have to translate Fergie's press conferences for some of the other Sundays, by the way. But I feel for Mason Greenwood. It's a big thing to deal with at that age. And he's having a very, very sort of abrupt introduction to being a top footballer in all sorts of ways. And this is part of it. He's got a really good person to protect him and help him in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And as I say, when you step back from it, you know, he's a kid that's made a couple of silly mistakes, but they aren't great big issues for me in terms of his football, his actual character. It just tells me that he's young and he's a bit silly at the moment.
What's your view on it, Anne-Marie?
I don't know why. I fail to see why this is in the public interest. I work within the industry as well, and I don't understand why would the public be interested in this type of story. And I'm speculating, but I suspect someone's approached the newspaper and go, oh, I've got this video of Mason Greenwood doing something really wrong. And someone's gone, OK, let's run it as a story. I'd love for someone to go, actually, we're not going to run it as a story. It's not in the public interest. It's not going to help us sell papers. It's not worth our time. And leave it alone. I didn't understand why they needed to run the story in the first place. And as you mentioned, Mike, in the past, we've had stories about Jack Grealish and Berahino and Raheem Sterling. These are minor scandals, if you like, that really have no interest to me and to the wider public. So I agree with what Jonathan is saying. And it takes a lot to own up to your mistakes. We've all been there, you know. I have no doubt my parents, if I'd done it, would have torn a strip off me anyway. Mm-hmm. And then to get it in the newspapers and social media and on TV and on radio, that's a lot to take on board for an 18-year-old. And I know he's legally an adult, but that's still a lot for anybody to take on board, even in the public eye. So I think Jonathan's right. It's like old school journalism should have died a death a long time ago. And I'm hoping now, well, I say I hope now, I want now newspapers not to run stories like this anymore, because it's just not the way things should be done going forward.
Yeah, I wish I had your faith in that actually happening, to be honest. You mentioned Jack Grealish there, Anne-Marie. What's your view on him signing that new 5-year deal at Villa? Don't want to be too uncharitable here. Was that simply because he didn't get a better offer elsewhere?
Potentially, yes. And I think his heart is Villa. He's Villa through and through. You cut him in half, he bleeds Villa. And I think he loves that club. He's been with that club for a long time. And I read also an interview that he gave that he obviously spoke to Dean Smith, and he had a FaceTime with the owner, but he was also Christian Perslow, who is, to me, coming across as somebody who's got a very big vision about where he wants to take Aston Villa. I spoke to Anita Asante the other day, who's just joined Aston Villa Women, and she sat down and had a conversation with Christian Perslow, and he sold her this amazing idea about where he wants to take the club. And I think they've got big plans for Villa. They deserve to be, or to remain in the Premier League. They've got fantastic supporters up there. And I think for him, he wants to help them achieve what they want to achieve. And I think, to be honest, the interest in Manchester United probably did wane away, I think, the minute talk started about Jadon Sancho. For me, Jack Grealish, he works hard, he's dedicated, he's got a natural ability. Yes, he's been overhyped at times, which player hasn't nowadays? But I think for me, it's the right call. It's the place he wants to be.
Yeah. What about Burnley? We talk about, you know, people with vision. Sean Dyche had a fundamental vision for that club, which he's actually fulfilled. They start at Leicester. Is this going to be another defiant season, or are you picking up the indications, Johnny, that the Dyche era might be winding down?
Yeah, it does look like an end game, but it might be a long, slow end game, actually. Where can he take Burnley? You know, he's what did he do? Finish sixth, seventh again, which would be unbelievable, but they've sort of done that before. There is a ceiling there. I actually understand where the owners are coming from, where the executives are coming from, because why would they, you know, that's a club that was on the brink, what, 20 years ago. Why would they want to kind of take all those risks and gambles in terms of signing older, more experienced players on big wages? So I just think there's a natural kind of end to it in sight. You hear quite a few things about Sean and clubs that are interested in him. I mean, that's been around for a couple of years, but I think maybe there's a couple I've heard of that are more sort of firm than before. And I think that will end when the vacancy is there and someone goes in and gets Sean Dyche, and there'll be a new era for Burnley. But one thing I'd say is that group of players, it isn't all Sean Dyche. That group of players is incredibly unified and strong, and it's got great characters, likes of Ben Mee and Ashley Barnes and so on. And they will survive a lot of stuff. They've survived all the politics already. And I've got sort of trust in them that whatever happens at the top, they'll sort of battle through. Defiant, Mike, you're right. They'll defy things and be all right this season, even if Sean does end up going.
Yeah. Now we spent today talking about huge sums of money, millions upon millions being spent at the highest level of the game. Macclesfield went bust yesterday for the sake of £500,000. Loose change. Southend have 6 weeks to repay their debts, or they could suffer a similar fate. Fans have lost their club, and football is facing a nuclear winter. More clubs are under threat. The question is, what can be done to ensure a sustainable future? There are no simple answers. But Amory, what would you like to see happen in the next couple of months, or even over the next 3 to 5 years?
I had a long think about this last night, and I was thinking a few things. You need to sort out the rules and methods of association when it comes to the EFL. I think you also need to sort out the new owner's test, or is it still called the fit and proper person's test? I get confused now what they call it, but you need to sort that out for sure. Also, stop thinking about your own vested interests. Think about the bigger picture. Think about the fans. Think about what football delivers to local communities. Stop thinking about yourselves and think about the bigger picture of what football can do, bringing people together, social cohesion. Yes, it's all about, I appreciate that you've got to think about your clubs and the players and so on and so forth, but there is a wider community here that also needs to be considered. And I think there's sometimes too many vested interests have clouded people's judgment sometimes when it comes to certain things. I also think there needs to be a little bit of greater control about cost and about spend. Clearly, some teams have spent beyond their means, and we're seeing that now. And Macclesfield is not the first. It's not going to be the last, put it that way. You know, Southend, as you mentioned, Mike, potentially they're facing some bills that they need to pay, and other clubs as well. I also think the government needs to review football governance. I know people are reluctant about the government getting involved, but I think we're getting to that point now, because clearly EFL and various others cannot sort it out for themselves. So I think potentially the government should step in. The solidarity payments that the Premier League have helped with, I understood that they've paid some of the money and there's more due to come, but maybe the Premier League cannot be seen as a place as to go to cap in hand asking to sort out the EFL and the clubs and so on and so forth. They can only help so much as we'd love the Premier League to do more. I think the EFL and the clubs need to look at their own sustainability. How can they generate funds in this difficult time? And one way to do that is to push the government to allow more fans, obviously using social distancing rules, back into the grounds and the stadiums, because that money can help keep clubs going. And I'm sure there's a way they can figure out how to do that. And also look at future parachute payments as well. I'm not entirely sure that that's a system that has worked in everybody's favour. That'll be my final point really on that. But I think for sure clubs in the EFL are facing an uncertain future. I'm all for the salary cap. I know that there's been some anger and some concerns about how that's going to work for leagues one or two, but it's the right step forward. It's going to take a little bit of time trying to get it to the place where it needs to be, but I think it's long overdue to have a salary cap.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpick there, Johnny. Let's look at, there's an estimate that the EFL clubs are losing around about £20 million a month with grounds empty. This weekend, it looks like there'll be 9 games with 1,000 fans in. You know, okay, that's a baby step forward, perhaps. But let's look at the systemic issue. Is football capable of looking after itself? And by that, I mean, you know, it's been talked about in the past. Should football get an independent regulator to be almost like the ombudsman for football?
You know, you kind of put your finger on it there, Mike. It is self, well, maybe regulation or being self-sustainable, being responsible. That's the biggest issue. Like, the EFL gets a lot of criticism. Maybe people don't understand that the EFL is not an all-powerful body like the FA or whatever. The EFL is just the clubs. So the executive, the Rick Parry and David Baldwin, who's the new chief exec, and the guys there, they can only do what the clubs tell them to do. So their ability to move on things like cost control is limited by how willing the clubs are to embrace it. As Anne-Marie said, the salary cap is an absolute must. First thing they need to do is start to get rid of the madness that pervades the Football League in that attempt to get to the Premier League. But even getting the salary cap has taken a long time. It's still not over the line in Leagues 1 and League 2. At the Championship, there's will there, they say, but there's not really any movement, because what you've got, of course, is clubs that are desperate to get the Premier League thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, yes, we need this, but not now, because now we want to get into the Premier League, so we'll have it in a few years' time. That needs to stop. So whether an independent regulator is able to do that, I don't know. Again, it comes down to the clubs accepting being responsible. And they face this really bleak situation now without fans, with no TV money coming in. They have to be sensible and do something that's not selfish, that's for the good of all the clubs in their league. But does football have the ability to do that? We don't see it very often, I'm afraid. I do think there has to be a bailout of some sort, but it's probably like a last chance bailout. It's a one-off, because from Premier League point of view, they're saying, well, if we keep giving you money, you then give it to basket case owners. They'd spend it on huge salaries for silly players. Why should we even bother? And I get all that. So, you know, to get through this winter, I don't see any other way, because they're not going to get the revenue from fans. They need that bailout, but it would have to come with strings attached. It would have to come with the club saying, from Championship down, cost controls, salary caps, and fit and proper owners. Anne-Marie mentioned it. That's the biggest problem. It's a problem in the Premier League, let's face it. It's not a Championship problem. It's a problem in the Premier League. And what we get is a vicious cycle where a club gets pushed to the absolute brink. We don't want, none of us who love football want to see it die. So we all get behind the idea that the next person's going to save it, but that next person's often worse than the last one. And there's a public pressure to get the deal through. It happens, and then somewhere down the line they find that, oh, wait a minute, this guy's just in it for a property deal. There has to be an end to that cycle. So maybe that's where your independent regulator comes in, that takes the heat out of those situations and is able to assess the would-be owners in real time. Then, because otherwise you just get South Ends and you get Berries and you get, you know, Burnleys and you get Wiggins. Not Burnleys, Macclesfield, sorry. Burnley.
Yeah, but what about, you know, there's a lower league manager of my acquaintance, Anne-Marie, who has insisted to me for years that Leagues 1 and League 2 really should go part-time. You know, he said, well, look around at the rest of Europe. There are two credible leagues at most in most countries. What about the possibility of the lower leagues going part-time and maybe even regionalised?
You know, I hadn't thought of that, actually, in terms of the lower leagues going part-time. I think there'll be massive resistance to that. Huge resistance, like Jonathan just alluded to there, about that the clubs are, you know, the clubs... a collective work in terms of the EFL, I think they would push back on that quite hard. And particularly they've been professional for such a long time. And I think Jonathan's right. There needs to be a radical change here, because coronavirus has changed things immensely. So I think it's not unreasonable to put that on the table, at least have it as a consideration, at least have a think about it. Maybe, I know it's a bit out there and it's a bit radical, but why not do it for this year or into the next season, just because of the coronavirus pandemic? Allow that to you know, this situation has changed a lot of things. This pandemic has changed a lot of things, and football needs to accept that, that changes will have to be made. So, yes, I think it's a worthy suggestion. Put it on the table. It's probably going to get a lot of pushback because, as I mentioned, vested interest, but I think it's something that should be considered. As for regionalisation, I mean, you've kind of got that already within the lower leagues anyway. The problem is, though, I think for them is getting people through the door. And I know, from what I read, Brian Barwick has written to the government on behalf of the National League because they rely on live attendance for their clubs. And of course, the announcement came yesterday that some clubs within the EFL will be having at least 1,000 fans through the door. Why not do that for the National League? If anything, it's easier to do it for the National League because a lot of the grounds are outside anyway, if that makes sense. And you can space people out so they can watch the games. And I think for the National League, they will need fans through the door because, as I mentioned, the main source of their income is gate receipts.
Well, I'm hearing that some National League clubs are now offering more money than Football League clubs. And you're getting, you know, seasoned players who've played as high as the Championship turning up in the National League just from a, you know, financial standpoint. Johnny, just a final look at this. What about the fan-run model? You know, I went to see Bury AFC in their first home game a couple of weeks ago. AFC Wimbledon, you know, they've got their new stadium on the blocks. Is that a viable model?
Oh, I'd love to see something like that. I mean, I think the kind of German model of, 51% public or fan ownership would be amazing. But I come back to the fact that it's the clubs that control this. You'd have to have a whole lot of owners almost voting themselves out of business. And I can't see that happening, I'm afraid, Mike. I like the idea, but it would maybe require this independent regulator or you know, a kind of agency coming in to save the clubs and then imposing new rules, because I cannot see the existing owners and so on voting for something like that. But what we do need, what the fan model gives you, is people trying to run clubs for the long term and for the good of what the club is and represents, and not just a short-term personal financial gain. And that's, you know, what we've been talking about here, is what we need at Football League level.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, I spent one Saturday at Bury watching the Phoenix Club. I spent last Saturday at Accrington Stanley, which is run by Andy Holt, who's warned repeatedly that a financial reckoning is upon us. What's happening around those clubs in the cradle of the professional game in the Northwest is a social and sporting scandal. Two clubs gone, more to come? I fear so. And it could be your club next. Football clubs matter. They represent communities, hopes and dreams, and they must be protected soon. Thanks to Johnny and Anne-Marie for their thoughts and insights and opinions. And as ever, thanks to you for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.